At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
So here's the deal. We do still make stuff in this economy, you know, lots of stuff. American Manufacturing Part 2 on the program today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, May the 30th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today thumbing, figuratively, through a report the Federal Reserve puts out 8 times a year, a regional survey of the American economy, best known by the color of its cover. It's called the Beige Book, and it's usually got all kinds of quirky, anecdotal economic tidbits in it. By pure happenstance today, though, for our purposes, the Beige Book headline is that the economy is doing just fine, driven mostly this spring by American manufacturing. As it happens, this is day two for us of a series looking at what manufacturing is in this economy right now. It is 12.5 million jobs, about 11.5%-ish of the economy. So what we make and how we make it matters. Yesterday, we did textiles, a guy named Monty Galbraith running a denim factory in Columbus, Georgia, and how he is trying to make the changes that the global economy is telling him he has got to make.
Yeah, that ship sailed a long time ago. You know, going back and trying to rebuild NAFTA into, you know, what it was before then, nobody is saying that. I'm certainly not saying that.
Today, same city, a product that could not be more different, and a company that's kind of liking where trade policy is going.
So my name is George Boyd, Jr. I'm the vice president with Golden's Foundry and Machine Company, and we're in our Columbus, Georgia facility, our foundry and machine shop.
How's business?
Business is good. We're very busy right now.
Golden's makes iron, cast iron parts for things like heavy-duty trucks, farm equipment and tractors, mining and oil and gas equipment, road and bridge construction as well. They've got a direct-to-consumer division, too, making cast iron barbecue grills and fire pits, but mostly, it's big, heavy stuff.
This is going to sound really stupid, but this is heavy industry, man.
This is heavy.
Absolutely is.
Big, heavy stuff they have been making in this same building since 1890. Lots of old brick walls. It's dark. You can basically get dirty doing nothing more than standing there. There is stuff seemingly thrown everywhere.
It looks for all the world that there's just random stuff lying around, but, I mean, I know in some inventory control system you guys know where everything's going, but
it's all in a designated spot, for sure.
That's Ed Boyd, George's brother. He runs operations. The two of them are fifth-generation owners and managers of this company, and they are feeling pretty good right now.
We had a little lull in the business, and it's come back pretty strong with some new work that we've got going. The cookers that we make are starting to get kind of busy
as well. The cookers,
there's
cast iron grills.
And then just the industrial economy is picking up.
How come?
We tend to think that it's some of the things that are happening up in Washington right now.
You're seeing that. You guys are feeling that here?
We are feeling that.
Tell me more.
I mean, coming out of the Great Recession, we didn't see business go away so much as during the Great Recession, we saw work stop. And so remember, we're making products for our customers' products. And so if they're not selling their products, they stop buying ours. So coming out of the Great Recession, we had a tremendous upsurge as all that pent-up demand kind of got flushed back into everybody's inventories.
Right.
After that, we went into a three-year lull where order books flattened out, and you heard people talk about the more gradual recovery. Well, that's what we were seeing. But now, over the last 18 months, it's revved up considerably.
Yeah. Are you thinking, now, as guys running a company, are you putting that on the tax bill? Are you putting it on regulatory changes that he's making, the president? Or are you putting it on something less tangible, like mood, I guess?
No, I mean, I think it's a little bit of everything, but certainly it's having more confidence that the administration is more business friendly, and you can feel a lot more assured if you're going to go out and invest in a piece of equipment
you'll have the opportunity for the business to support it, to pay it back.
Is that what you're hearing from your customers?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you know, in terms of the impact of the tax bill, we think that's going to be felt this year and in the following years. But I think mostly it has been. It's been a belief that this administration is moving things in the direction of bringing manufacturing back here, making this a place to continue to build things.
Just to get this out of the way,
yeah.
Are you bothered by the chaos, or do you guys just want to look at the bottom line and forget all the tweets and all the other stuff?
I mean, all in all, the direction that the country feels like it's heading right now is one that we agree with. I would do without Twitter for him in a heartbeat if we could, but the noise doesn't affect the day-to-day.
And look, we've had a consensus for the last 20 years in Washington, and it's been a consensus that has pretty steadily moved manufacturing out of our country.
Right.
So if it's a little chaos to interrupt that kind of consensus...
You'll take it?
It's overdue, yeah.
All right, let's go. See what else we got to see. Interestingly enough, neither Ed nor George were supposed to be here. Before the recession, George was a lawyer. Ed Boyd was a banker. But even though their father didn't really want them to come back, or so he says anyway, back they came. Not without challenges, of course, understanding the cycles of the global economy, for one thing. What trade policy means for this foundry stretched along the railroad tracks not far from downtown Columbus. Also, chemistry and metallurgy.
When people talk about iron or steel, I mean, iron is on the periodic table, right, is the Fe.
Yep.
So steel, the way we talk about it, is that Fe with just a little bit of carbon in it. We take that and we add significantly more carbon and silicon into the mix and some other elements and alloys to produce the cast irons.
Business, 10 years after the financial crisis, is going pretty well. There are 200 people in this building. They're looking to hire another 40 or so. And the Boyd brothers have some pretty clear thoughts on what they think American manufacturing is or ought to be right now.
You know, it's funny. There aren't as many people here as I thought there would be. But at the same time, there has to be a certain number of people here to get this done. My point is, I guess you can't automate all of this, right?
You can't. There's certainly more automation than we could apply, but you're going to always have to have attendants to monitor the automation.
Right.
One of the things that drives us crazy is when we hear people talk about the reason you don't have as many people in manufacturing today is all because of automation. It's not because the jobs have left, and that's just not true. And if you had been here 40 years ago, this line would have been floor molding, and it would have had five guys to a floor mold, very labor intensive. So some of those jobs have been replaced through automation, but we have a lot of people here.
Right.
And you're always going to have a lot of people here. It's really just trying to hide the ball on the fact that those jobs have been sent to Mexico and overseas.
What do you make, though, of the argument that, you know, we've been just in steel and metals and by inference, iron as well, we've underinvested in our steel capacity in this country since the end of World War II?
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's truth in that, especially when you look at what's happened over the last 40 years as we've allowed those jobs to compete against people that aren't competing fairly. I mean, there's no way when you ask me today to compete against China on a piece price basis, it's not a fair comparison at all. So where is the money from the tax reform going to go first? It's going to go to reinvestment. We put over $1 million every year just into new equipment to keep our processes going.
Goldens makes things that go into things, if that makes any sense. Raw materials in, intermediate products out.
And y'all do be careful because these will be hot.
Yeah. Oh, you can feel it from here.
And you can see
it's totally hot. Yeah, it's glowing.
Yep.
Wow.
So that's coming out of the sand.
It's kind of easy to forget, standing in front of that furnace with the noise and the heat and the grit, that from this corner of Southwest Georgia, Ed and George Boyd are trying to hang on in a global economy with, recently, a little bit of help.
Just because I'm thinking of it now and I don't want to forget. With the caveat that you guys make steel, right? I mean, make iron, right? Where are you on the steel tariffs and all of that that's going on now between us and the Chinese and the Europeans and the Canadians and the Mexicans?
Yeah, so the impact of that to us is twofold. The immediate impact of it is steel is our primary input.
Right.
Right? So to whatever degree those tariffs move the price of steel, we're going to feel it.
Are you feeling it yet?
Yeah, we're seeing a little motion. It's hard to quantify.
Hard to know if it's impacted by that directly, but we've seen a little increase in the last month or so.
Okay.
But it's about time that we start doing something to protect our domestic industries.
Absolutely.
And so if you don't have the ability to make steel here, you're losing a core industry that we need in our country. We'd like to see those protections spread in a way that we've got a balanced, fair trading platform with other countries.
You talk trade policy in 2018, you're going to get some politics. That's just the nature of the beast. And the Boyd brothers are counting on the politics of this moment to help them compete in a global economy that has changed around them and around their slice of American manufacturing. Tomorrow, episode 3 of Manufacturing in America 2018.
Oh, wait, I know what those are. Those are those little markers that you peel back the string in the wrapper and you peel off the, like, the paper sort of coating or whatever it is, right?
That's right.
It's like a grease pencil or something.
That's exactly what it is.
Yeah, I'm quick that way, right? If somehow you missed episode 1 yesterday, subscribe to our podcast, will you? You can listen to it there. On Wall Street today, agita. What agita? I think the Italian phrase here, if you remember back to the angst of yesterday, today it's va bene, va bene. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There is, as we mentioned yesterday, and have been really for the past couple of months as well, a lot to keep track of in the Trump administration's ongoing trade disagreement, shall we say, with China. Steel and aluminum tariffs, retaliatory tariffs, retaliatory tariffs, fights over intellectual property, which gets us to today. A plan being reported by the Associated Press to reduce the chances of American intellectual property leaving the country by restricting visas for Chinese graduates in STEM fields who want to come into this country. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains what that's going to mean.
Even the possibility of changes like this can be enough to change the way businesses operate. Vivek Wadhwa teaches engineering at Carnegie Mellon's Silicon Valley campus. He says about a third of his students are from China.
Businesses are going to be afraid of hiring Chinese engineering students because they worry about the obstacles that the government will place.
There's also concern that if Chinese students think they can't stay and work at American companies after graduate school, they just won't come. Kevin Shi researches labor and migration at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute.
It's going to create uncertainty for students who are applying here, for universities who are trying to attract talented graduate students.
The administration's argument for being more cautious about issuing these visas is the risk of intellectual property theft, which has happened. Daniel Golden wrote a book about it called Spy Schools.
But what's often left out of the discussion is that the vast majority of Chinese students who come here and get doctorates end up staying here for at least 5 years.
Often coming up with inventions or intellectual property that benefit the U.S., which is why, says Golden, China has made a big push to reverse that brain drain in recent years.
China might not be all that upset to see more of its best scientific minds staying home rather than going to the U.S.
So while the threat of stealing secrets or research is real, Golden says this kind of move might end up helping China more than the U.S. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up,
our choices around food have an impact, and I think people are increasingly aware of that.
The high-profile business of high-end food. But first, let's do the numbers. Va tutto bene, I believe, is Italian for the Dow Industrials, up 306 points today, 1 2/10%, 24,667. NASDAQ picked up 65 points, 9/10%, 74.62. The S&P 500 added 34 points, about 1.2%, ended things at 27.24. With the political situation in Italy looking a tad less worrisome, markets moved up today. Energy stocks powered higher. Marathon Petroleum advanced more than 2%. ExxonMobil filled up 4% today. Bank stocks bounced back after yesterday's shellacking. Bank of America banked 1.8%. JP Morgan Chase deposited 2 2/10%. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.85%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
I'm Shepard from Lincoln, Nebraska, and I listen to Marketplace several times, actually, every day, because it's got the economic news and developments that are important to me. I donate to Marketplace so that it can be available to everyone, and I hope you'll join me in this effort. Thanks.
To join Shepard as a Marketplace investor, donate online at marketplace.org.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. A couple of stories now about corporate mergers and acquisitions, why they happen and what they mean. Item one, Big Ag, Big Agriculture, a $66 billion deal just got the go-ahead from antitrust regulators. The German conglomerate Bayer has been cleared to acquire St. Louis-based Monsanto, which, as you might know, has profited for years from the success of its herbicide Roundup and from seeds that are designed to be tolerant of it. Now, though, adaptive biology being what it is, the company's having to bet on its next-generation products. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong has that one.
Monsanto's been a pioneer in high-tech herbicides and seeds the last two decades. Farmers plant Monsanto's genetically altered seeds, say corn, soy, cotton, spray Roundup, and voila, only the weeds die. It adds up to an estimated $10 billion in sales every year. But nature has struck back through superweeds that are Roundup resistant. Mike Bolje teaches agricultural economics and business at Purdue.
Weeds do develop resistance, some weeds more rapidly than others to some chemicals, but it's a natural phenomena.
So now Monsanto's betting on a Generation 2 herbicide, a new chemical called dicamba. But it gets blown away by the wind and can kill crops next door that aren't tolerant of dicamba. Big crop damage in 10 states last year. Jonas Oxgaard is analyst at Bernstein Research.
Roundup, it doesn't really drift. You put it on the field and it stays in the ground, and that's it. But dicamba, it has a higher volatility. It evaporates from the field and it can be blown away.
He says there's a risk dicamba could get pulled off the market. And Monsanto faces broader criticism from environmental groups unhappy about gene-altered foods and the toxicity of its chemicals. Still, a lot of farmers in the world use these products, says analyst Chris Perella at Bloomberg Intelligence.
I would say almost all, if not all, of the corn and soybean produced in the U.S. and in Brazil and Argentina is resistant to herbicide, at least one form of herbicide at this point.
Which is a big reason Bayer is buying Monsanto. The final regulatory approvals for the deal could come in a couple months. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Item two in the corporate roundup involves an international conglomerate that's perhaps not as widely known as it ought to be. JAB is a holding company run out of Luxembourg by a secretive German family, apparently worth billions of dollars. Food is what it does, a lot of it, and looking for more. Back in January, JAB paid $26 billion for Dr. Pepper Snapple. Now it's added to its roster by grabbing the British sandwich chain Pret-a-Manger, which is French, I know, but the company is British. $2 billion was the price tag there. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank took a look at what the company is doing, and here's a hint. It's about coffee.
You're a JAB customer when you drink your morning coffee from Pete's, when you grab lunch from Panera Bread, even when buying K-cups for your Keurig. Michael Schaefer is with market research firm Euromonitor International.
Anywhere consumers are paying more for a good cup of coffee in any form, JAB seems to be looking to have a piece of that.
JAB has spent about $50 billion in recent years buying up mostly coffee and coffee-adjacent brands like Pret-a-Manger.
I think they're looking 5 to 10 years down the road in a space that is changing pretty rapidly.
All over the world, consumers are paying more for coffee. Rabobank analyst Jim Watson says in trying to become the king of coffee, JAB is looking at beer.
They viewed it the way beer was maybe 20, 30 years ago, which is this very fragmented industry, but one that has great growth outlook.
The beer industry is now quite consolidated. And so Watson says JAB wants to do the same thing with coffee and prepared food. But there's another global coffee brand standing in the way.
JAB, over the last 5 years, has really risen up to be kind of a direct competitor to Nestle.
Nestle is making moves of its own. It bought a majority stake in indie coffee brand Blue Bottle last year. And this month, Nestle grabbed Starbucks' packaged coffee business for more than $7 billion. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
If you follow what's going on in the world of food and restaurants and cookbooks and food journalism, you will know of the James Beard Awards, the Oscars of the food world, they're sometimes called. Of note this year for having more women and people of color among the winners than ever before. And that's after months of stories about some high-profile chefs who were abusive in their kitchens and who were accused of assaulting women who work for them. As it happens, the group that gives out those awards, the James Beard Foundation, has a new CEO. She started just earlier this year. Claire Reichenbach is her name, and she is today's conversation from the corner office. Claire, it's nice to speak with you.
Good to meet you, and thank you.
I do want to talk about the awards here in a bit because they're important and they're relevant. But I want to talk for a second about you, just to sort of frame it. You don't come from food, as it were. You come from television and media.
I come from the media world, yes. I don't hail from the culinary world, per se. Background is more in terms of business strategy and business transformation, uh-huh. which obviously has applicability. But I'm a very authentic food lover and home cook at heart. So it's an area of deep passion of mine. But as you say, I'm not the usual suspect in terms of stepping into this role.
Was the James Beard Foundation then in need of strategy and a little bit of guidance, I guess?
Well, I'm lucky to be stepping into the foundation at a time where it is in the greatest strength it's ever been. There's a phenomenal team here, and the evolution over the last few decades has really brought it to the position it's at now. But I think the area that I really want to bolster it and shine a greater light on. We've got some very powerful initiatives. One is around sustainable seafood, which is a national ratings system whereby we work with chefs and restaurants in terms of looking at how they can change their suppliers to more sustainable supply. Another example would be our efforts towards food waste reduction, again, in critically important areas. So there's a couple of examples that of what we're doing in terms of the impact side of the house, as it were.
So let's talk about the awards for a second. One of the reasons, yeah. other than the fact that they are the James Beard Awards, that they got a lot of press this year was that for the first time there was a substantial coterie of people of color and women winning, which is great. My question for you, though, is how do you keep that up next year?
That is the question. And I think it's worth saying that, you know, diversity has been a core component of our mission at the foundation for years. At the beginning of the nomination process, we introduced a new yardstick in terms of character and conduct. And you could really see that come to bear this year. So I think it's about saying progress has been made. Let's not rest on our laurels. Let's make sure that we build on this. But fundamentally, it's about saying, what is the role for the foundation in terms of driving that systemic change to ensure that the culinary community and the restaurant industry is at its heart more inclusive and diverse, and not just that the awards are reflective of that, but it's actually materially shifting.
Yeah, to that question of systemic problems and the word you keep using, which is conduct, the restaurant industry writ large has been and is still a very, very difficult place for women to work. There are outstanding examples, and I use that not in the good sense, of horrible incidents. What is your role and what can you do as one of the leaders of the culture, I suppose, to make the restaurant industry more receptive and open for women?
I think there are a number of things that, again, that the foundation is already doing, but I'm deeply impassioned about really putting our shoulder against this and driving a scale impact of what we do. But one is shining a light on the exemplars that we can start to kind of build a playbook around what good looks like. The second piece is around really equipping women in a very pragmatic way. So we think that actually women owners, so as well as, you know, chefs, but really restaurant owners, that is where a lot of the systemic and institutional change will be driven from. So that is an area that is a key priority for us.
When you go out to eat at a restaurant, what are you looking for? Are you looking at decor? Are you looking at food? Are you looking at service? What are you looking for?
I think I'm no different from, I think it's the whole experience and the ambiance. But I think people, and I included, are taking a deeper look in terms of where we are electing to spend our money, because our choices around food have an impact. And I think people are increasingly aware of that.
Claire Reichenbach, she is the CEO of the James Beard Foundation. Claire, thanks a lot.
Many thanks indeed. Great talking to you.
There's more, as there always is, of this Corner Office conversation, specifically with Claire Reichenbach about her plans for the James Beard Foundation and its future. You can hear that on our Corner Office podcast. This final note on the way out today, which it is quite possible you've heard about already, but which I believe it's important to get on the record. Santa Fe Aventis, the maker of Ambien, came out with a statement this morning, given the news of yesterday. In relevant part, it reads, "While all pharmaceutical treatments have side effects, racism is not a known side effect of any Santa Fe medication." That's all I got. All right, we're going. Dow Industrial's up 306 points today, about 1.2%. NASDAQ up 65 points, 0.9%. S&P 500 added 34 points, 0.2%. Va tutto bene, indeed, huh? Sarah Bruguiere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a good weekend, everybody. Not a weekend, no. It's not a weekend night. Sorry. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.